Good afternoon, and welcome to Outlook Live. I'm Mike VanderVelde with the Federal Reserve, and I'll be your facilitator. Today, we'll explore consumer compliance, common violations, and hot topics. Let me be the first to welcome and thank our presenters. From the Chicago Fed, we have Assistant Vice President over Compliance and CRA, Janice Fronczak. From the Minneapolis Fed, we have Senior Examiner, Catherine Miner. Now, we're going to hear from them in just a moment, but first, let's jump over to slide number two and cover some of the logistics. If you haven't done so yet, click on the webinar link that you received after registering, or you can head over to our website as seen on slide one, and that address is www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. There, you can find the session materials and eventually the archive of the call itself. Just a quick note on the webinar. We encourage you to listen to the audio through your PC, but there is a phone line option that you can access at any time. If you're having difficulties, feel free to pick up the phone and switch over and listen to us that way. On the webinar tool, you may have noticed an overflow number in case that first line fills up. As for questions, our presenters receive some in advance, but please do submit your new questions by clicking the Ask Question button there on the webinar tool as well. Okay, I am going to turn over to slide number three, and I'm going to pass the mic to the host of our call from the San Francisco Fed. That's Mr. Jason Liu. Jason, take it away.
Great. Thanks, Mike. It is my pleasure to be opening today's webinar on common violations and hot topics. As you can see from slide three, we are planning to address four main topics during today's webinar, including common violations cited during our examinations and some of the more substantive issues that bankers routinely run into and some suggestions for mitigating the associated risk. In particular, our topics will include the Home Mortgage Disclosure Act, the spousal signature provisions of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, flood insurance, and Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act, or UDAP. So we do have a full agenda. Before I hand things off to our speakers, I did want to mention that the Federal Reserve System also publishes a quarterly newsletter entitled Consumer Compliance Outlook. Both the Outlook Live webinars and the Consumer Compliance Outlook newsletters are part of the Federal Reserve System's outreach activities, are free of charge, and can be accessed at www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. So with that, I'll hand things off to Catherine Miner with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. Catherine, the floor is yours.
Thanks, Jason. Could I have slide four, Mike? We're going to start today by talking about HMDA because HMDA accounts for several of the most common violations across the country. Before we get into the violations themselves, I wanted to remind you why the data's accuracy is so important by quickly covering how it's used and by whom. So local governments use HMDA data to evaluate the health of their current housing markets and then also to make decisions about public housing efforts and investments. Community groups analyze HMDA data to identify locations for their investments, and some groups also use the data to identify discriminatory lending patterns. Other financial institutions, they might review competitors' HMDA data to analyze their market share and also for benchmarking. For example, they might be doing a fair lending risk assessment and look at their competitors to see what their origination rates to minorities are. Examiners for the Federal Reserve Bank, as well as other agencies like the FDIC and the OCC, even including the Department of Justice, use the HMDA information to evaluate compliance with anti-discrimination laws like the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, as well as in evaluating a bank's Community Reinvestment Act performance. Under CRA, examiners look at how a lender meets community credit needs. The importance of the data means that the thresholds for error are quite low, generally about 10%. And when error thresholds are exceeded, the data typically has to be corrected and then resubmitted. Next, we'll get into some of these common violations in the reported HMDA data, as well as some strategies to address those errors. Slide five, please. Today, we're going to cover four of the most common violations in HMDA. The first is rate spread. Many of the rate spread violations are attributable to reporting a rate spread on loans that aren't subject to those reporting requirements. Specifically, this would be loans like loans that have a commercial purpose, and as a result, they're not subject to Regulation Z, loans that the bank may have purchased instead of originated, home equity lines of credit, or home improvement loans that aren't secured by a dwelling. A rate spread also shouldn't be reported for loans that have an action taken code of anything other than 1, which stands for loan originated. In other words, you don't want to report rate spreads for denied or for withdrawn applications. Rate spread violations are also commonly the result of data entry errors. For example, using the wrong loan term, which sounds straightforward, but it can be more involved. So let's go through a couple examples. On adjustable rate loans, the term is the length of the time to the first rate change date instead of the time to maturity. On a balloon loan, for example, where the payment calculation is based on a 30-year amortization period, but the term to maturity is only 7 years, then it's the term to maturity that should be used when calculating the rate spread, not the amortization period. Another common cause for rate spread errors is when the interest rate is used for comparison purposes instead of the annual percentage rate. A best practice for rate spread reporting is to print a copy of the calculator's output once the information is entered and submitted. This facilitates the verification process, and it can be useful to catch minor mistakes, things like selecting a first lien instead of a second lien. It can also be helpful in determining why the error occurred and then enable you to find a better corrective action. So we'll move next to the action taken code and the date. For the most part, violations that involve the action taken and the date the action was taken involve applications that don't become originated loans. Loans that are originated, those are reported as code one, loan originated, and typically the note date is reported as the action taken date. Other options for the date that might be used are the settlement date for the loan or disbursement date, typically used for loans subject to rescission. All of those dates are acceptable. They should generally be consistent for the loan type or for the particular department or product. The more difficult situations in reporting the action taken involve, 1, when counteroffers are made, 2, when applications are approved, but the applications are not heard from again, or the applicants are not heard from again, or 3, when a notice of incompletion is unheeded. So let's walk through how to report these applications on the LAR. For example, when a counteroffer is made, but the applicant doesn't use the offer, the action taken should be reported as code 3, application denied. If the lender sends a written notice of incompleteness to the applicant, as described under Regulation B, and doesn't hear back from the applicant within the time specified, the action taken code is 5, file closed for incompleteness. If the lender approves the application but never gets a response from the applicant or the broker, you want to report the action taken code as 2. Application is approved, but it's not accepted. Applications that are conditionally approved, meaning that the applicant has to meet underwriting conditions, and these would be other than the usual loan commitment or consummation conditions, such as clear title or acceptable survey. And the applicant doesn't meet those conditions, the application should be reported as code 3, application denied. Code 4, which is for application withdrawn, that should only be used in cases where the applicant expressly withdraws the application before a credit decision is made. So next, we're going to talk about property location. And property location on the HMDLAR is made up of the codes for the Metropolitan Statistical Area or the Metropolitan Division, the State Code, the County Code, and the Census Tract. Many of the errors involving the property location are caused by the reporting of the wrong property address or typographical errors. For example, the incorrect spelling of a street name, a number transposed on a house number, or the current address instead of the address for the property that the loan concerns. Those can all result in an incorrect property location being reported. More complicated loans, particularly those that are secured by more than one property, those might require a little more research before reporting. The commentary to Regulation C identifies several multi-property situations, and it provides guidance on which property's location should be reported in those instances. Some property location violations occur because the bank's process for coding the property location didn't return a reliable answer when the address was entered. This happens routinely in the case of new construction or development, and it can also happen regularly in rural areas. In these situations, a reliable backup system should be available. Typically, this would involve combining a mapping process to get a good feel for where that property is actually located, and then comparing that to the location of the census tract boundaries. Now we're going to talk about applicant data, and this includes the race, the ethnicity, the gender, and the income of the applicant or the co-applicant. Many of the violations that involve applicant data are the result of reversing the applicant and co-applicant's information. The error often happens when the information on the application is transferred from a handwritten version to a typed version. The information should be reported just as it's completed by the applicant and co-applicant. The other common source of violations that involve applicant data is when lenders either don't request applicant data when they should, or they don't note the applicant's data when it's required. Lenders are required to ask for the monitoring information for all applications and orally in the case of telephone applications. If the applicant chooses not to provide the information, then the lender should use visual observation or surname in cases where the application is taken in person and note the information about the applicant and co-applicant. Lenders are required to follow Appendix B of Regulation C when it comes to collecting this information about the applicant and the co-applicant for a loan. Income errors are typically the result of reporting income when the applicant is not a natural person, such as when they're a business or a trust. They can also be the result of reporting a figure other than the income that was actually relied upon in making the credit decision. For example, a bonus might have been used in underwriting, but only the salary gets reported under HMDA. Slide 6, please. So now that we've covered some of the most common violations under HMDA and some strategies to avoid them, I'd like to spend a little more time on compliance management. So the first practice that I'll mention, because it's just so important, is to avoid relying on boarding data or other HMDA worksheets when performing your data reviews or your audits. Often the error is made when the boarding or the worksheet data is completed, so it's critical to go back and review the source documents. When I say source documents, I mean the application or the note. If or when you find errors during your data reviews or audits, errors happen, it's important to investigate the root cause underlying that error. It will significantly, if you get to the bottom of an error, it will really reduce the likelihood that the error will recur, and it'll also enable you to make a determination about whether or not that error is likely to be widespread. For example, the bank may have a loan in a new subdivision that defaults to the center of the census tract, or the census tract at the center of the zip code when the address is entered. And once you realize that after performing a review and you've figured out what the root cause of that error is, you can go back through the LAR and identify any other loans that are secured by property in that same subdivision and make similar corrections. Another suggestion for the audit or other review is to include an evaluation of whether loans that are subject to HMDA are reported and included on the LAR. It might take you several reports to identify the list of loans that have the right purpose, have the right collateral, but failing to report all the applications can lead to resubmission. The first step in accuracy with HMDA is to make sure that all those applications that need to be reported are actually reported. Regular HMDA training is important. It's important to support staff in both maintaining and expanding their knowledge of the requirements. Another best practice is to have a system in place for answering questions and conducting research. As we've pointed out today, not all of the situations are straightforward, and often the first step to avoiding a major error is to make sure that there's someone to ask who's knowledgeable and has access to resources. Using internal question and answer documents or other aids are very helpful in improving the accuracy, particularly in the initial reporting. Flowcharts with simple yes-no questions, those can be used to tell staff whether a loan should be reported, whether a rate spread should be reported, or whether the action taken code should be a 2, 3, or a 5. Standardizing processes is another method of improving your data accuracy. eliminating any guesswork for which information to use, and also aligning one process in the organization with another can streamline the process and reduce errors. For example, always using the adverse action notice date as the action taken date for denied applications. And lastly, as you know, automation can be a valuable tool in eliminating those typographical errors just by eliminating the human element. Slide 7, please. The last slide that I'll cover about HMDA concerns the future. As you know, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau proposed several amendments to HMDA. According to the CFPB's published regulatory agenda, the expected date for the final rule is August of this year, and I've included a link to that agenda on the slide. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act requires at least a 9-month period between issuance of the final rule and data collection under the new rule. That means that the first data collection can't begin until at least January 1st of 2017. And that's not to say that the CFPB won't set a longer implementation period. It just, that's the absolute earliest date that the reporting could be required under the amended Regulation C. Slide 8. We've included a link to the current proposed HMDA rule on this slide, as well as the December 2014 Outlook Live called the Consumer Compliance Hot Topics 2014 Year in Review, and that covers the proposal. I've also included a link to the 2010 Outlook Live called Tips for Reporting Accurate HMDA and CRA Data. That provides more information on improving data accuracy for both HMDA and CRA data reporting. I think you'll find it useful. Now I'll turn it over to Janice to talk about the spousal signature requirements.
Thank you, Catherine. Next slide, please. We'll now speak to spousal signature or signature requirements under ECOA and implementing Regulation B with a focus on marital status discrimination. As you well know, the Federal Reserve supervises state member banks with assets of $10 billion or less for compliance with ECOA, which prohibits discrimination on the basis of marital status. There are specific requirements within Regulation B for when spousal signatures can or cannot be obtained on notes and/or guarantees. The violation of these requirements and the potential for a pattern or practice of marital discrimination is one of the most frequently cited violations and does actually result in a number of fair lending referrals to the Department of Justice. Next slide, please. So we thought we'd start here with the general rule. And I'm going to read the general rule as it's on the slide. It states that a creditor shall not require the signature of an individual applicant's spouse, other than a joint applicant, on any credit instrument if the individual applicant qualifies under the creditor standards of creditworthiness. So, in other words, in general, if the individual applicant is creditworthy, the financial institution should not require an additional signer to the note or to the guarantee. If the institution does require additional signer, the creditor must justify and document why. Additionally, the creditor cannot require that the additional signer to the note or to the guarantee be the individual spouse. So next we'll go through some of the general requirements for spousal signatures, as well as some exceptions and common mistakes. Next slide, please. So the rule provides that the creditor may obtain spousal signatures with the documentation of joint intent. And this is a pretty key area where we do see a lot of issues within our institutions. A creditor may require the signatures of both spouses on the note if the spouses have applied as joint applicants and have affirmed this intent. So one of the most common mistakes that examiners see is the failure of the institution to document the intent of the applicants to apply jointly for credit. Regulation B in its commentary outlines these requirements for documenting joint intent. So the first is joint intent should be documented at the time of application, not later in the process and not at closing. The second piece is that in order to document joint intent, it should be done in a manner that is distinct from means to affirm the accuracy of information, meaning that it is separate and distinct from items such as a joint financial statement, which, based on commentary and a number of other discussions, institutions should know that that is insufficient for documenting the intent to apply jointly. We do recommend using the model forms as outlined in Appendix B of the regulation. Oftentimes, due to the use of model forms in the retail space, creditors tend to document joint intent properly. However, as ECOA applies to all forms of credit, documenting joint intent in the commercial and agricultural spaces, where oftentimes there is no use of a model form or even a standard application, can very easily translate into violations of signature provisions. To ensure that your institution does not violate signature provisions, implementing strong controls such as a separate form to document intent and ensuring that it is completed accurately and at the time of application can assist in mitigating potential violations. Next slide, please. So here we'll talk about a few exceptions. Generally, as mentioned on the earlier slide, the rule is that a creditor may not require the signature of the applicant's spouse if the applicant is creditworthy. However, Regulation B provides several exceptions to the rule for obtaining spousal signatures. Understanding these exceptions, how to apply these exceptions, as well as clearly understanding why the exception is applicable to your business process is critical. So in the upcoming slides, we'll discuss three exceptions, two of them related to collateral and one to business credit. The first exception, as outlined on this slide, is for secured credit and access to the collateral for that secured credit. So in a case where an individual applicant qualifies for secured credit, I'm going to emphasize this here, the creditor may require a spousal signature on any instrument reasonably believed to be necessary under applicable state law to ensure access to the property in the event of default. And that's a key phrase. Where we tend to see errors is that the creditor assumes that the instrument that is reasonably believed to be necessary is the note rather than a security instrument. So the note, for example, actually expands personal liability for the debt repayment rather than a security instrument such as a mortgage, which more appropriately limits the spouse's liability to the property. Next slide, please. So we're going to continue with some of the exceptions for unsecured credit, and very similarly, Regulation B provides an exception for unsecured credit. Here we have basically the language is very similar to the secured credit exception, where a creditor may rely on may require a spousal signature on any instrument reasonably believed to be necessary under applicable state law to ensure access to the property in the event of death or default. So again, what we do see when this is operative in institutions, the most common error in the space is, again, when the creditor fails to use the correct instrument. One other piece, and this is not necessarily an exception, but one other piece that we wanted to point out with regards to unsecured credit are around the requirements on valuation of an individual applicant's jointly held assets when applying for unsecured credit. So in Regulation B commentary, it does state, and quote, if an applicant requests unsecured credit, does not own sufficient separate property, and relies on joint property to establish creditworthiness, the creditor must value the applicant's interest in the jointly held property. A creditor may not request that a non-applicant joint owner sign any instrument as a condition of the credit extension unless the applicant's interest does not support the amount and terms of the credit sought. So in other words, a creditor cannot require a non-applicant joint owner to sign any instrument, for example, the note, without having first evaluated whether the individual's interest in the jointly held property is sufficient to meet the creditor's standards. Blanket requirements for obtaining non-applicant signatures without first conducting this type of evaluation would be in violation of signature provisions. Next slide, please. On the previous two slides, we mentioned reasonable belief with regards to the appropriate instrument for securing collateral. So here we'll just share a little bit more about that reasonable belief standard, and that it's a pretty key phrase. So while exceptions may permit spousal signatures on particular instruments as allowed by state law, one common error that examiners see is that a bank may reference this exception as what I would phrase as an anecdotal permission, but cannot provide a legal analysis to support their policy or practice. It is strongly suggested that creditors obtain the legal analysis to support their reasonable belief prior to implementing a policy or practice requiring spousal signatures on a security interest or note. Also, while a financial institution may try to submit that legal analysis during the course of an examination once examiners have already identified potential violations, violations may still result as the legal analysis really should have been obtained prior to implementing the policy. Next slide. So we'll shift now into obtaining guarantor signatures and the third exception to the general rule, which applies to business credit. The exception provides that in the case of business credit, the creditor may require the personal guarantee of the partners, directors, officers, or shareholders of a closely held corporation. However, as the slide shows, the requirement for the signature must be based on the guarantor's material involvement in the business and can never, ever be based on marital relationship. So here are a few common errors that we see in this space. The first is that spousal guarantors are obtained, yet the institution cannot substantiate the spouse's material involvement in the business as a partner, director, officer, etc. A bank can save exam time by clearly documenting in the files the spouse's connection to the business. Another common error that we see is that a bank's practice requires the guarantees of all spouses of the principals to sign, regardless of whether the spouse is involved in the business or not. And then the third violation that we tend to see is that loan officers impose this requirement even though it is not the bank's policy to do so in general. Banks may want to conduct regular reviews or audits to ensure their policies, practices, and loan officers are very attuned to the requirements and provisions under the regulation. Next slide, please. So this last overview slide speaks not to an exception to the rule, but rather to a separate rule, and that is, if an individual applicant does not qualify for credit, the bank may require additional parties, but cannot require that that additional party be the applicant's spouse. So in other words, if an applicant is not creditworthy, it is permissible for an institution to obtain additional support for the credit. What the bank cannot do is imply, suggest, require that the additional signer or guarantor be the spouse of the individual applicant. If indeed the spouse volunteers to provide the additional support for that credit, documenting accordingly will assist examiners to see that the bank is operating in compliance with this rule. One last piece with regards to renewals. If the individual applicant's creditworthiness is reevaluated at the time of renewal and a new underwrite occurs, and that individual is now creditworthy according to the creditor standards, the institution is expected to release any additional parties that were previously required. Next slide, please. So in order to provide some examples of what we just discussed, I've put together a couple of scenarios here, and we'll just walk through them quickly. So the first scenario is this. Sally Jones applies for a term loan for her small business and provides joint financial statements as part of the application process. The bank adds Sally's husband to the application and requires both spouses to sign the note. Is this permissible under Regulation B? Next slide, please. So the answer here is no, the bank's practice is not permissible. So Regulation B, clarified by the amendments in 2003, prohibits a creditor from presuming that the submission of joint financial information constitutes an application for joint credit. Thus, where a financial statement lists jointly held property of a husband and wife and is signed by both spouses attesting to the accuracy of the data, there would be ECOA and Regulation B problems if a creditor treats the financial statement as an indication that the husband and wife are making a joint application. By doing so, a creditor may find itself requiring both the husband and wife to sign the promissory note when, in fact, only the individual who's involved with the business intended to be obligated on the extension of credit, potentially resulting in a pattern or practice of marital discrimination. So one last piece on this, although the presence of two signatures on a financial statement may not be used to show an intent to apply jointly for credit, signatures or initials on a written application obtained at the time of application and that affirm the applicant's intent to apply jointly will suffice. Where there's no written application, again, the application's intent to apply for joint credit may be evidenced, for example, by the presence of a written statement in the file that expresses such intent. Next slide. So scenario two says the bank provides a loan to ABC Marketing, which is owned by Mark Phillips. The bank's loan officer requires Mark's wife, Sue Phillips, to provide a personal guarantee, although she has no relationship to the business. During the bank's exam, the loan officer tells examiners that he always likes to get the wife's guarantee. Is this permissible under Regulation B? Next slide, please. So pretty straightforward and simply, the answer is no, this bank's practice is not permissible. And here, just I'm going to read straight verbatim from the slide. If the business is creditworthy, the bank may not require the personal guarantee of a spouse who is not a partner, director, or officer of the business. Next slide, please. So lastly, we're providing a few risk mitigation strategies to assist in the compliance with signature provisions under the regulation and the prevention of potential marital status discrimination. The first is ensure that there are clear Regulation B policies and procedures for all credit products. And we stress here in the commercial and agricultural space, as these are frequent source of violations. The second is to ensure adequate training for loan officers. The third, and again, I stress this, is this again is another source of common violation. Obtain adequate written evidence at the time of application of the spouse's intent to jointly apply for credit. The fourth, obtain appropriate legal analysis prior to implementing spousal signature requirements. And then fifth, conduct periodic reviews or audits for compliance with Regulation B. One key point to add to that last bullet point, if your institution identifies an issue, make sure that you understand the extent of those issues. Is it an isolated incident? Does it appear to be systemic? Is it embedded in one business line, or does it encompass multiple business lines? And once the root cause is identified, remediate. Taking those steps give examiners extra confidence in the quality of your compliance management program. Next slide, please. And on this slide, we've provided some additional resources to help institutions understand and comply with signature requirements. Okay, next slide, please. So here I'm going to move into another area, moving from ECOA to actually flood requirements. And this is another area of one of our most frequently cited violations. They are actually the source of several of our enforcement actions. So specifically, I'm going to address two sites, 208.25C1 and 208.25G, because each agency issues its own flood insurance regulation. If you're not regulated by the Federal Reserve, you should probably refer to your own regulator's version and sites, although substantively they're the same. So the requirement to purchase flood insurance when the loan is secured by a property in a special flood hazard area is one area where we see frequent violations. The requirement states that a loan should not be originated, increased, extended, or renewed without appropriate flood insurance coverage. Flood insurance coverage is required for the term of the loan on buildings or mobile homes if, one, the institution makes, increases, extends, or renews any loan secured by improved real estate or a mobile home that is affixed to a permanent foundation. Two, the property securing the loan is located or will be located in a special flood hazard area, as identified by FEMA. And three, the community participates in the National Flood Insurance Program. While the requirements are actually fairly straightforward, here are some key risk areas for you to think about and instances where we tend to see failures in a flood compliance management program. One, are your operations decentralized and do loan officers have the sole responsibility for ensuring coverage? Two, are you calculating the coverage amount correctly? And three, do you have monitoring processes to ensure that adequate coverage before loan funding occurs? So oftentimes when there's insufficient coverage and there is a violation of the site listed on this slide, it's due to highly decentralized processes with few or poorly managed front or back end controls. Additionally, violations tend to occur when loan officers do not have the right or all the training they need to ensure that coverage is sufficient. So moving on to the second site, the lack of timely force placement, I'll cover a few scenarios where we see frequent violations. The first has to do with remapping, which is when FEMA updates flood zone maps. When this occurs, a lender may become aware of the remapping and the fact that certain properties within the institution's portfolio fall within the newly mapped flood zones. So one scenario that we tend to see fairly frequently is that upon becoming knowledgeable that a property is in a flood zone, institutions do not send out notice within a reasonable amount of time and then do not commence with force placement. So while reasonable is not defined by the regulation, several months is generally not a reasonable amount of time. Examiners expect to see that upon knowledge that a property has been remapped, that the institution's flood management program is effective in commencing the notification and force placement processes. The second scenario that we frequently see references instances where there is a lapse in coverage or the coverage is an amount less than required. So the FDPA specifically provides the lender or the servicer for the loan must send notice upon determination that the collateral property securing the loan is either not covered or is not covered or is covered in an amount less than required. Oftentimes in this scenario, what we hear from institutions is that they may be trying to work with borrowers to minimize payment shock due to the increased premiums. And while this may be true, force placing in a timely manner is actually still required and critical. We have seen instances where force placement has not occurred after several months to over a year's period of time. If you review the flood exam procedures, there are two critical questions that are evaluated for force placement. One, does the institution provide written notice to the borrower stating that the necessary coverage must be obtained within 45 days of the notice or the institution will purchase it on the borrower's behalf? And two, does the institution purchase the coverage on the borrower's behalf if the borrower does not obtain the required policy within the required time period? It's important to know that the failure to execute on these two critical questions raises concerns to examiners about the quality of an institution's ability to comply with flood provisions. What may ensue in these scenarios is a complete file search to determine the extent of pattern or practice. Next slide, please. So this brings us to the question of pattern or practice. I've outlined here, and this is all available through the flood Q&A released in 2009, what constitutes a pattern or practice. While I won't read them all, in the interest of time, I will highlight a few over the next two slides that we tend to see most frequently. So the first is consideration number one, a common cause or source within the financial institution's control, including third-party vendors. So examiners look at this and take this into consideration, for example, when there is a process or practice within the institution that appears to systemically violate the requirements for flood compliance. An example of this might be an instance where an institution broadly employs a calculator that is incorrect in determining the correct coverage amounts. The next consideration I'll speak to is item three. So non-compliance occurred over an extended period of time. So this item speaks to an examiner's concern that an institution does not have the ability to address compliance in a timely manner. For example, as mentioned previously, if an institution has not force-placed in a timely manner, resulting in months or years of delay, non-compliance has occurred over an extended period of time. Examiners do expect to see that an institution is identifying non-compliance and then addressing those issues promptly. Next slide, please. The next consideration for pattern or practice that I'll address is item seven, and this is a financial institution's internal and or external audit process has not identified or addressed deficiency in its flood insurance compliance program. So I think there are a couple of scenarios that we see with regards to this element of pattern or practice. So one may be that an institution hires an audit firm that does not evaluate all aspects of flood compliance. Another scenario that we may see is that an institution conducts an audit or has an external auditor that actually doesn't understand the flood requirements, resulting in either erroneous findings or even potentially no findings when, in fact, examiners come in and during the course of the exam unearth compliance issues. Or three, an institution has an audit that adequately identifies issues, but yet the institution does nothing to remedy those findings. All of these instances raise concerns to examiners about the quality of an institution and effectiveness, truthfully, of an institution's flood compliance management program. And then lastly, item eight. The financial institution lacks generally effective flood insurance compliance policies and procedures and or a training program for its employees. So the lack of an adequate training program or an understanding of the requirements actually tends to be fairly common in instances where we do see violations. We may see that decentralized loan officers have different degrees of understanding of flood requirements, and we've also actually seen instances where compliance staff might not have a clear understanding of flood provisions. For example, a scenario where a property may be remapped, and that's new to the institution, so really not fully understanding the flood requirements that ensue in that scenario. Next slide, please. So this is a discussion. I just want to bring in the discussion of civil money penalties because I do think this is important to understand with regards to pattern or practice. So the Flood Disaster Protection Act requires enforcing agencies to issue civil money penalties or CMPs when a pattern or practice of violations of the listed sites on this slide are determined. So this may be common knowledge, but I bring it to your attention here so that you can begin to think about how you may want to risk focus your compliance management program. While your overall compliance, your flood compliance program should be strong, these are key areas that, if you have a systemic breakdown in your process, will in essence result in CMPs if a pattern or practice is determined. The next slide, just very quickly, speaks to the changes in the amount of civil money penalties. They were increased to $2,000 with the passage of the Biggert Waters Flood Insurance Reform Act of 2012. So now I'll pass it over to Catherine to speak to some of the new requirements under the flood insurance rule.
So
going to cover the final flood insurance rule, and this was issued in a press release on June 22nd of this year and then published in the Federal Register on July 21st. So the agencies published the final rule to implement the Biggert Waters Flood Insurance Reform Act of 2012 and the Homeowners Flood Insurance Affordability Act of 2014. So as you may recall, some provisions of these two acts were effective upon their enactment, and other provisions required the agencies to write regulations before becoming effective. As a result, the effective dates of the provisions of the provisions in the final rule vary. So I've included the dates on each slide to help distinguish what's a new requirement of the final rule versus what's already in effect. So the first part of the final rule that we're going to cover is the exemption for detached non-residential structures, and that's been in effect since the enactment of the Homeowners Flood Insurance Affordability Act on March 21st of 2014. Specifically, the HFIAA provided a new exemption from the mandatory purchase requirement for flood insurance coverage. That is for a structure that's part of a residential property, but it's detached from the primary residential structure and does not serve as a residence. So a common example of this is a garage that's used to store vehicles, but it's detached from the home. The final rule provides additional information that defines detached non-residential structure that doesn't serve as a residence, which I've shown on the slide. In addition, the final rule states that the lender has to reexamine the detached structure upon a triggering event. And under flood, that's when a loan is made, increased, extended, or renewed. And if the lender finds that the property no longer meets the exemption, then it should require adequate flood insurance coverage. Slide 29, please. The next topic of the final rule I'll discuss relates to the forced placement of flood insurance. So Janice just covered the basic rule, which is when the lender or servicer becomes aware that the flood insurance coverage is lapsed or is insufficient, it has to notify the borrower to obtain adequate coverage. If the borrower doesn't obtain that coverage within 45 days following notification, the lender or the servicer has to obtain coverage on behalf of the borrower. So those requirements remain unchanged. What Biggert Waters did clarify was that the lender or servicer need not wait to force place coverage, provided it refunds all the premiums and fees for any overlapping period once the borrower obtains his or her coverage. So these changes were effective with the enactment of the Biggert Waters Flood Insurance Reform Act, and that was on July 6th of 2012. So CA Letter 13-2 detailed that information, and the final rule does not change the requirements. It just codifies those requirements. And I did include a link to the CA letter on slide 32. One note, the final rule clarified that the borrower demonstrates adequate flood insurance coverage by providing the lender or servicer a declarations page that includes the policy number for the insurance and the identifying or contact information for the insurer. Slide 30, please. Next, we'll cover one of the new provisions of the final rule. So effective on January 1st of 2016, the final rule requires, unless an exception applies, and we'll go through those in a minute, that the lender or servicer require escrow of all flood insurance premiums and related fees for any loan that's made, increased, extended, or renewed on or after January 1st of 2016. So let's talk about the exceptions. The first exception is for small lenders, and small lenders are not required to escrow for flood insurance premiums if, on or before July 6th of 2012, when Biggert Waters was enacted, the lender was not otherwise required by law to escrow for taxes and insurance and did not have a policy consistently and uniformly for maintaining escrow accounts. The defined asset size for a small lender is less than $1 billion at the end of either of the two prior years. The loan-related exceptions to the mandatory escrow requirement, which I've listed here on the slide, were adopted as they were proposed, and we discussed those in a December 2014 Outlook Live webinar. Again, I have a reference to that webinar on slide 32. For example, escrow accounts aren't required for flood insurance premiums in the case of agricultural or commercial purpose loans, home equity lines of credit, or loans where flood insurance coverage is maintained through a homeowners association or another governing body that might be in place at a cooperative, for example, as well as the others I've listed on the slide. The final rule explains that if a small lender becomes ineligible for the exception, it has until July 1st of the first calendar year to begin escrowing for flood insurance premiums. Slide 31, please. As we just learned, the mandatory escrow requirement for loans whenever a triggering event occurs on or after January 1st of 2016, so that would be whenever it's made, increased, extended, or renewed. For loans without triggering events in the portfolio as of January 1st of 2016, the lender or servicer is required to extend the option to escrow to the borrower. By June 30th of 2016, for all designated loans that are in the portfolio as of the first of the year that don't already have an escrow account for flood insurance premiums, the servicer has to mail or deliver a notice to the borrower with the option to escrow. The notice should include language similar to what's included in Appendix B of the regulation. These are model clauses that you can use. Included in the notice is an explanation of an escrow account, basically how the borrower is going to pay a monthly premium with the mortgage payment, and then the lender or servicer will pay the flood insurance premium from the account when it's due. It also should include instructions on how the borrower can obtain more information and how to request the escrow account. The bank has to begin escrowing for the flood insurance fees and premiums as soon as reasonably practicable once it receives notification from the borrower. Slide 32 includes several resources that we think you'll find useful on flood insurance compliance. I'm going to turn it back over to Janice now to cover UDAP.
Thank you, Catherine. So next slide, that's titled UDAP Examples. As we all know, UDAP has become a fairly regular part of the consumer compliance language over the last decade. So while UDAP is not one of our most frequently cited violations, it definitely does fall into the category of a hot topic. We're regularly asked by bankers to provide additional insight into the types of issues that we encounter. So here we put together a slide that shows some examples of UDAP concerns that have been identified in examinations and through complaints, as well as a brief description of the type of UDAP concerns. So while I'm not going to go through all of these, I am going to point out, and again, this is probably common knowledge, that there isn't a single product that dominates UDAP concerns. UDAP covers both credit and deposit products alike. It can cover products throughout their life cycle. It can include processes, features, practices, and or policies. Next slide, please. So in light of the fact that UDAP covers a myriad of products and aspects of products, these next two slides in the product lifecycle may help to provide a lens for institutions to think conceptually about UDAP. Hopefully, it's a helpful framework for our institutions to begin to consider where and how to manage UDAP risk on a product-by-product basis. These next two slides, the product lifecycle is segmented into several key phrases with some general descriptions. It may be helpful to think about how these phases, or think about these phases as institutions develop new products, modify existing products, or work with third parties to offer features and or services. So on this first slide here, there's four different phases: management considerations, product design, marketing, and initial interface. And I suggest that you look to the definition or description there for additional kind of background on what these different phases may mean. So the next slide, we've got origination or consummation, usage, and termination. Essentially, where your institution may be modifying an existing product, onboarding a new product, a service, a feature, a channel, or platform, you may want to ask, what has changed in any or all of these phases, and are we offering the product or service in a manner that provides clear disclosure of terms and costs? Are there deficiencies in our new or modified processes that have the potential to create consumer harm? And again, in an effort to risk focus, where might your institution see the potential UDEP risk, and how would you manage that with the appropriate control environment? So one other key area where we tend to see elevated UDEP risk is third-party relationships. Catherine will speak to this briefly on the next slide.
Third parties can figure prominently in UDAP cases. One recent case involved a bank partnering with a third party to open deposit accounts for students as a way for the students to access their financial aid. The UDAP enforcement case against the bank resulted in a consent order, which addressed the participation of the bank and the third party in deceptive practices in violation of the UDAP provisions of the FTC Act. These practices included omission of material information about how the students could get their financial aid refund without having to open the deposit account, and the omission of material information about the fees, the features and limitations of the deposit account product, which may have made it more difficult for the students to make fully informed decisions prior to selecting the method for their financial aid refund disbursement. The case illustrates the importance of selecting vendors and third parties very carefully, using a level of due diligence that's appropriate for the risk. In addition, we recommend banks regularly monitor their third parties to ensure that the third party is maintaining compliance with consumer protection laws and regulations, including UDAP, as well as fulfilling its responsibilities as agreed in the contract. In SR letter 13-19, which was a joint CA letter of 13-21, it's called Guidance on Managing Outsourcing Risk. That was issued in December of 2013 by the Federal Reserve, and that highlights the potential risks arising from the use of third parties, including compliance risk, and it also describes elements of an appropriate risk management program. It's important that the due diligence that you conduct when you're selecting the third parties incorporates an assessment of UDAP risk. So, for example, questions you might ask during the due diligence process could include the following. Does the product or service the third party offers have features that are complex, perhaps difficult for a consumer to understand? Does the third party's risk management program include an evaluation of compliance with applicable consumer protection laws and regulations? Do they monitor complaints? Is the resolution to complaints overseen? And does the third party's audits or other testing incorporate a review of consumer interactions? And that would be like listening to customer calls or reviewing marketing scripts. So these are just some of the examples of questions a bank might ask of a third party that might enable it to better assess the UDAP risk involved. And completing this type of analysis can provide the bank with additional opportunities to mitigate UDAP risk by, for example, incorporating access to the third party's audit reports and complaints into the contract language. Slide 37 has several UDAP resources for you, several CA letters on the topic that I think you'll find useful in managing UDAP risk. And I will turn it back to Mike now.
All right. Thank you very much. So it looks like we are right at the top of the hour. If it's all right, let me just sneak one question in here. We did get a ton of questions in here, and we really appreciate that feedback. It helps us fill in the gaps in our content. And from there, we'll either decide to make a further publication to answer some of those questions. But again, we'll take all of those into consideration, so we appreciate that. So let me ask this question briefly. Did I understand you to say that commercial loans require a rate spread?
So just to clarify, I went through the common violations that occur on HMDA as well as what's actually required for reporting. So you do not report a rate spread for commercial loans if the loan's not subject to Regulation Z, which would be the case if it's for a business purpose, then, or it's a home improvement loan and that home improvement loan is not dwelling secured, or it's a loan that you purchased, you would enter NA for the rate spread.
All right, very good. Thank you for that. And that does take us to the top of the hour. Again, we really do appreciate all those questions that were submitted, and we will actually take this into consideration, the possibility of a publication or additional Outlook Live sessions based upon the questions that you submitted. So feel free to keep those coming. They will be noted. With that said, I do want to let you know that we are going to push out a survey here in just a moment. Matter of fact, I'm going to push that out to you right now through the webinar tool. Please do take just a moment to fill out that survey. We read every single response, and there's a lot of you out there, so keep those comments coming. I'd like to thank you all for joining us today. A special thank you to Janice, Catherine, and the Outlook Live team for their time. And as a quick reminder, remember to check our website. That's www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org for the archive of this call and for information on upcoming sessions. Everyone have a great afternoon, and we will catch you on the next call.